listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Tonight's performance, Storytime, coincides with the publication of Bill T. Jones's new book, Storytime, The Life of an Idea. And the performance and the book are a conversation and a questioning of the ideas and methods of John Cage, about which you will hear more. I want to give special thanks to the Center for the Art of Performance at UCLA, to the staff there, the marvelous performers, and the creative team from the Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane, and company who are here from very snowy New York. Now, please join me in welcoming Bill T. Jones.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
My name is Christy Edmonds, and I'm the director of the Center for the Art of Performance. I'm also somebody who has had the great, deep honor of working with Bill T. in the past when I was running the Melbourne International Arts Festival. So I just wanted to quickly, I'm not going to talk a lot. We're going to set things going, and then I'll start turning to all of you with questions. And before I get going, how many of you feel like you have something arising in your mind? Okay, I'll be relying on you later. Okay? So, Bill, you had spoken earlier when the performance was just beginning. You mentioned that chance procedure. You talked about that and utilized it. And it's interesting, having also worked with Merce a lot, and not Cage, but knowing very intimately how much he had developed it, what caused you to start being allured to it?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I don't think it's possible to be a contemporary dance choreographer after Merce in 1954, whenever he started using it, and not be affected by it.
Yeah.
We used to always look for things to happen in the studio. So it was always a tool, but I don't think it was until I had just done a series of highly ambitious works that were trying to craft text and all sorts of different things together. And then when they're over, you know, the response is what it is, and then you feel a little empty wonder, why do another work? And I think that that's one thing that John Cage gave to us. He says, well, maybe you should take away some of those questions for yourself. You don't have to have the answer for them.
Right.
Why don't you give an outside agency? And I think Storytime came from that desire to get back down to the business of writing and thinking and feeling, and at the same time doing what my brilliant associate artistic director, Janet Wong, does with me, and that is, how do we keep our wonderful group of dancers alive and learning and material?
Yeah.
How do we bring the past and the future together? I think that's why it sort of happened when it did.
I one of the things also for the audience who may not experience a lot of contemporary dance, and I just wanted to, what was remarkable for me watching them is you are going through a variety of text and stories verbally, which is its own dance.
Yes.
You know, in its pacing, its time, its delivery, and that kind of thing. But the content of it is also moving through time, back and forth in time, across different points in time, which you do spatially a lot in your choreographies as well. The dancers are dealing, I think, also with their own, not narrative, it's not a narrative story, but the physical vocabularies of the literacy in their bodies, right? And dance is often transmitted not from a direct emulation. It's really these different vocabularies influences the physical variety of different choreographers they've worked with. So the extraordinary intelligence of history through their bodies in the movement sequences and the choreographies by Arnie, as well as yours, actually we were witnessing a vast sort of speed through of knowledge, which was astonishing. I mean, I could read it through many, many different levels. But one of the things I wanted to, you know, Bill has made so many major, major works. But you choreographically, and I was thinking about this as well in the using of the you know, chants, there's something that runs underneath a lot of your work that seems to have something to do with trust.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
It's funny, yeah. Yeah. Funny you should say that, because the day started with a conversation with somebody, I mean, about middle age being a bitch, because the world seems to be shifting and you don't trust everything that took you from A to B is not guaranteed to take you from B to C.
Right.
And that are issues of the heart, issues of the mind, conceptual ideas, political ideas. So trust is there. Maybe trust and the lack of trust.
Mm. Well, trusting that some impetus or stimulus will cause, after the emptying out of a work, a replenishment is a major amount of trust that artists undertake.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the trusting of yourself to engage in this little item here. I was so thrilled when I saw the book, when I knew you were doing the book, but when I saw the book itself. Rarely do we have, I mean, if it's true that history tends to see what was put in print, then the artists who work in our most ephemeral form, dance, have a very difficult time with what history will see, right? Really, I mean, often performers and audiences, even like tonight, you become the permanent collection and the archive of this particular experience in this way, and how you possess it is, you know, a form of a different kind of archiving and your own kind of trust. Rarely do we have an opportunity for our major artists in live performance practice, and dance in particular, to write. So thankfully there's video and a variety of other things. But nonetheless, history doesn't see an archive often of a bunch of videotapes that go into something. But they do see something about this. So what's interesting to me about it was, not interesting, something that was generous about it, is that you said yes. You said yes to the idea of finding a way, not identifying as an author, to accept the potential, the opportunity, the potential to embed a performative intelligence into an object.
Yes.
Right?
With the help of a collaborative team.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But how many of you have seen the book or read it, or just so I can get a sense? Okay, you're going to be doing all that later, except for Ken, of course, Ken. So tell me about your process with this book.
Well, I was invited by the African American Center at Princeton and the Toni Morrison Lecture Series to do a series of lectures, one a week for 3 weeks. And part of the agreement was the lectures would be done and then they would be made into a document. So it wasn't that I was dying to do a book, although I'm really grateful for it. And when I could do it about anything I wanted to do, and I know that I had been working on story time, and I had all this growing list of stories at that time. So one thing that was very attractive was, how do I get it published? Oh, here's an opportunity to just publish the stories. But there were those lectures. So the first one, which is called Pastime, the second one was a performance, not unlike what you saw here tonight, but there was no dancing, and it was my companion and the creative director of my company, Bjorn Amelan, was drawing on a board. This was in Princeton in one of their classroom lecture halls, very full of atmosphere. The third section is called With Time. So I tried to make three different experiences, one of which, true to who I am, was going to actually be a performance. That is, in fact, a lecture. And the last two, the first and the last, would be talking about how I was introduced to Cage, what Cage meant to a person of my description in the early 70s when I was first introduced, and all the ramifications of a certain type of art making and attitudes about art, story time, as we mentioned. And then there was the last one, With Time, and I was asking, how has the idea weathered? It's a very, his idea of indeterminacy, I think, has, it's all just a part of us now. And so it's in good shape. How has it weathered in me?
Right.
That's how the book came about, and that's what I was fortunate enough to be able to put down in writing. And I say it was a team because Fred Appel, who is the editor at the Princeton University Press. He and I developed a very lively discussion back and forth. And there was a wonderful Maria Lindenfelder, I believe that's her name. I hope I get it right. She's a designer of it. And one thing I have to realize is that I'm comfortable speaking. It's part of my DNA. It's part of my tradition. But I was very wary of something that Skip Gates, Henry Louis Gates, head of the African American Studies Department at Harvard, said: "Black oration is dead on the page. Black oration is dead on the page." What the hell?
Yeah.
But you know, probably right. You got to be there. Mm-hmm. You have to, and can you look at that speech, pick it up, and feel it? Black orators are, particularly when we're really let go, it's about that moment. It's about singing. So what Fred did was there was a speech, but he would make me, well, what are you actually getting at here? And when you're doing a speech, you can just like say something and let it hang, and the audience does the rest of it. So he and I had a little fight about that. I'm saying you're making me flesh out something that should be left indeterminate. But you said you're writing a book, and people have not, unlike you, have not had any sense of what the performance is like. And maybe people don't know who John Cage is. Maybe they don't know about you. Maybe they don't know about your tradition. And so it was. He was actually very good for me, in a way. Very good for me.
Right.
Yeah.
And you say in the early on in the book that it's because it does have a performative strategy inside of it, I think, where you do let things trail, but not in a way that causes anyone to stop.
Yes.
Right. But you say that you felt conflicted.
Yes. The document. I say the document is conflicted.
Yes.
It is an artifact, and yet it is an artifact of performance attempting to be a book. And that's okay with me, actually. Mm-hmm. The thing that you're holding in your hands in the preface, I think it's a preface introduction, is conflicted. And that's a pretty honest way of looking at how I feel being in the world, actually. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. I want to make sure we're going to have time for some questions. Are they starting to percolate up? Okay, let me move you a little bit differently. I want someone to talk a little bit about the experience they had in watching this dance and choreography. Not a monumental monologue about the experience out of respect, but some essentialness, something, a word or an essential. Please.
It's going to be a question at the end, is that okay?
Bring it.
So I was thinking about women and our bodies and time, how we have a cycle every 28 days. And, or so, it depends on what time of life it is. And I was watching them on stage, and the sort of the premise of this whole event. When you choreograph, at what point do you think about, I know this one was appropriately two men, but when do you think about a woman's body versus a man's body through space and time? When do you identify that this should be a female dancer or a male dancer?
Gone through various...
Good luck with that one.
We've gone through a lot of changes. There's a thing called contact improvisation.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with it? And contact improvisation was greatly democratizing of dance in the sense that the paradigm of a classical pas de deux is that the woman becomes an idea, a sylph, a thing, and the man is invisible, and that she does these things. So if you find a system that allows the small person to lift the big person, already you're on your way to something else. Now, I'm 6'1". Arnie Zane was like Eric's height, 5'4". So we had a kind of a thing going on there, and he was very adamant that he did not want to be in a subservient position. So we had to get rid of that ballet paradigm. Now, at that, when we were working at the Dance Asylum, Lois Welk was our lead teacher, very robust and not a traditional dancer at all. Jill Becker, the women were really wild. And Arnie and I, we all worked together, but he and I were companions, lovers. So there was always a special place. Now, when we had our own company, the question was, I really wanted them to be as fierce as possible, because Arnie said that he really disliked ballet pas de deux, partnering. His take, and I think it might have been unfairly, was a lot of homosexual men lifting heterosexual women around the stage. And he said, I don't know, you can't read. I read around that time in the late 70s, Jacques Dambois saying that people wouldn't believe it, but in the ballet world, there were 60% of the men on stage are heterosexual. Therefore, this wasn't fair. But that's what our take on it, at least Arnie's was. So we wanted, our company was going to be an image of the world that we want to live in and not the world that we live in. Now, your question is very peculiar after, because you want to take it to talk about issues of woman's body. My dancers in my company right now, they're not subjected to the same doctrinaire attitude I had when Arnie died. Yeah. The women were expected to, everyone did push-ups. Yeah. Everybody was supposed to be interested in this weight sharing and lifting. Lo and behold, by the time we roll into late 80s, 90s, there were women who were not interested, actually. Vive la différence. You know, I'm not really interested in picking up your big ass. You know?
And or your socks.
Or your socks, right. You know what I mean? So I'm trying to understand where we're at right now. And as you know, right now, first of all these were made between 1979 and 1982. It was a different world. But as you know, that there is now the polarity. This is what I'm learning, and I guess you're learning it too. We're in a brave new world now in terms of gender identification. I have to be reminded regularly, it's not men and women and gay and straight. There is a whole panoply going on between the two. Mm. So now that being said, how do you rephrase your question? In other words, I don't have a transgender person in my company. I'm looking out for them. How do I find them? And how do you, in an audition, want it, male dancers, female dancers, how do I say want it dancer? You know? I don't know. So how do you rephrase your question?
I just think it's interesting that I think bodies move differently, and you have in your mind how you'd like to see the dancer move.
Mm-hmm. And then in that thought of how I'd like to see the dancer move, do they become a gender to you in your mind?
Mm. Well, Terry Gross, NPR, great interviewer, she asked me that question once. Well, so tell me, are there masculine movements and female movements? Now,
have you seen Terry?
Pardon? Oh, I have not, actually. But there was, traditionally it was understood that we go to the ballet, right, that the per allegro, those things that that take delicacy in filigree, or the epaumont, all those things were in the realm of the female. Balanchine has even said ballet is woman. The men were supposed to be, you know, in the class, and now we're going to do the big jumps. And the men, they slow the tempo down, and now the big jumps. Suzanne Farrow liked to take class with the men, because she wanted to do the big jumps. So that's a classic paradigm of a female area and a male area. Now, we know that, first of all, in the modern dance world, those things don't matter, because God knows I wish I had more people who had the facility of that in their feet. But everyone now is expected to be able to do everything.
Yeah.
But not everything. I mean, some partnering, why strain with certain things? And Bill, if you want to talk about harmony and a loving relationship, does it have to be still the way you and Artie used to do it, with the struggling and the lifting, you know? Mm-hmm. What do you know about the way people really have sex? What do you know about the way people really love? What is intimacy? Mm-hmm. What does intimacy look like on the stage? And that's mm-hmm. been a journey, and women have helped me understand that. Mm-hmm. And I have to get out of the way. You know, I have to get out of the way, and because I don't know everything about the human experience, and yet on stage you'd like to have be potentially expressing it all. So you I'm know, still learning.
One of the things as well is, you know, when we think of John Cage and what he contributed, which was vast and a lot, mm-hmm,
really,
obviously.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to show you actually his rehearsal studio when you're here tomorrow. But before he moved to New York. One of the things about him, too, is that he did something that was, I think, in hindsight and current, and definitely current when he was working, was cracking open a certain kind of, untrodden upon field of snow. Mm. He moved in directions that opened pathways and gave permission to leap towards them, interrogate them artistically, compositionally, musically. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Bill's companies have also done that very thing. You have done that very thing. Mm. One of the things, if you don't know the history of his company, he and Arnie, the body types inside of the dancing bodies was infinitely radical, in which dancers of extraordinary scale and size, weight differentials, there was no utopian body in multiple stages of your dance company. And I think it's very important. A lot of women, tiny little women, teeny tiny, tall, all kinds. So we're very mixed. So I loved when you had said that earlier. It was
well,
like
thank you for that. But you know what? We never had. We really never developed a lasting relationship with a person with a disability.
Right.
On whatever the correct way of a person. We never, because of the business of the dance, the way we understood it, we never had found the right person who could be one of those persons. Yes, we had Larry Goldhuber at 300 pounds.
Sure. Right, and Heidi Latsky.
Yeah, Heidi Latsky and so on. But we never made that, like I'm saying right now, transgender people.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Sure.
I'm open to it. Yeah. It's about the personality as well, and does the work suit them?
And the push-ups.
We don't have to do the push-ups anymore. We don't have to do the push-ups anymore, you know?
Who's thinking now? Ah, please, up in the back here.
I found myself struck at the beginning by a tension between wanting to listen to your words and wanting to watch the dancers, and the beauty of each of them was pulling me in opposite directions. And I'm just curious if you could talk about your intention there, and then also talk about your process of writing and how that's different or similar from your process of choreographing, even though I know this is Arnie's choreography, but just in general.
Well, you know, I was really trying to use John Cage as a mentor. And, you know, there's a very famous Cunningham piece where he reads his indeterminacy piece, his stories, and Merce's company dances. And, you know, when I think back, and I've seen that piece twice, I can't remember his stories. I remember the presence of he and David Vaughan, but I was so like watching Merce. So I feel that I hope that by the end of the half an hour, because you know the piece is 70 minutes long, something begins to happen. I know when I watch it, I'm really uncomfortable the first 10 or 15 minutes. Then after a while, I stop trying to control it, and sometimes it's about the story, sometimes it's about the movement. And sometimes there's these kind of happy or maybe kind of odd and unsettling occurrences, these things that happen. Like, what about the story? Faggot! What happened there? What happened there? What happened for you? Where were you at that moment?
I felt...
What were you watching? What were you listening to?
I was listening, and then I looked for their response in movement. At that exact moment, but I think you're absolutely right. That was my experience of it. Eventually, I just let go and didn't worry about that my mind or spirit wasn't large enough for the work. And just
or that you're not, you're missing something, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, see, I think John Cage is so fantastic because it's a terrifying amount of freedom that he gives to you, the creator, and you, the audience. Mm. And, you know, this is something I talk about in the book, which I didn't know before I started researching it, that Cage had this notion of three tiers of composition, because you realize he was a composer, not a choreographer. The first, he thought, the first most important thing was the composition, what the artist was doing, and what the artist was doing for himself. The only reason to make something was the artist is finding out something for himself. The second was what he called the execution. And as you know, he had famous fights with when he tried to go into symphony orchestras and so on like that, with the way people, they didn't take him seriously, what the freedom he gave and so on. So he had his own feelings about that, but he wanted the work to get out there. And the third, he thought, was the experience of the audience. So I think he had a very, very tough, and I think, I dare say, perverse take on the theatrical experience. Mm. He's not there to take you on a journey. You don't start with the theme, and then you have, and he takes you back home or what have you.
Yeah.
Wasn't interested in that. And that little bit of the story, the one that where Betty brought into my performance, I was interested in the duet. It was as if it never needed to stop. It could go on forever. There was something very subtle and sly he was saying to me at that moment about my desire to be theatrical and dramatic and to move you, to get to control the way you feel. Well, at least that's what he said. Mm. But I know that he was an artist, and an artist, most artists I know, performing artists, want to be embraced. They want to be embraced on some level. They want to feel that there's a communion. Maybe he really was over it. So for me, it's a very difficult problem, knowing that, oh my God, she shouldn't have had to worry one moment about what to be. If I was a better artist, I would have made the experience so that she would always be carried along. And believe me, I work in Broadway. That is the language in commercial theater. That is the language. Once you lose them, that's bad piece. They paid you to come and make sure that you take care of them from the time they walk in that theater until they leave. They paid you for that. Now, here we're supposed to be in some loftier precincts. Right?
Yeah.
What do I owe you? And you might say, and what do you owe me? God knows John Cage and Merce know what it's like to empty an auditorium.
For decades.
That's what we were taught. Those were the big boys.
Yeah.
You want to play with the big boys? Then you got to get rid of this idea of them people loving you. They will come to you. And, you know, they're right in a way. John Cage is still out there. I mean, those people, he doesn't get programmed. But Merce is now a god. Mm. Morse is a god. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So, but am I playing that game? Am I going to make you come to me? No, I am a very ambitious motherfucker. And I want to win. Not always proud of it, but I want to win. And what is winning? Well, we can talk about that.
Yeah.
How you get the rent paid. How do the dancers have health insurance? How does Christy book me again?
Yeah.
You know? And that's a whole science, isn't it? Mm. So, shall we move on? Yes. Yes. Right.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the things, too, is that, and it's an important distinction in entertainment and performance, and a lot of time dance falls in this place where people move towards it feeling as though the virtuosity of what will take place will be entertaining. Mm-hmm. And you, in a way, when it's an art choreography and an art dance, as an audience member, have to find those points. Because I'm asked this all the time.
Mm.
The artists who work in entertainment modes often are seeking, or entertainment unto itself, are seeking that we all have and arrive at the exact same place at the same time, emotionally, right? The outcome is known, and it is then dressed with creativity and opportunity towards repetition, to hit that note, to hit that leg movement, to hit that thing every single
time. It's a
time.
Product.
It's a known outcome. Mm-hmm. All things are delivering towards it. Mm-hmm. And an artist, if an artist knows the outcome that they are going to get, they stop making right there. Mm. That the pursuit of the unknown outcome is the endeavor. And in doing so, you author and gift our ability to find the value proposition inside of that work.
That's such a generous thing to say to artists. Do you feel like most artists actually aspire? That it's about discovery?
I notice that they'll have...
I know for me it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Artists, real, real, true artists will... Mm-hmm. In fact, when often an artist is making something, and this is one of the deep, like, to me, betrayals of grant applications, is that it asks you to identify the end point before you've begun. And it's already vulnerable enough to have a doodle on a napkin, right? So if you have to prove, as an artist, the idea, its end game, its outcome, in order to seek the resource capacities that might allow you to explore an experiment towards your hunch, your intuitive obsession, something. Most artists, if they have to already know the outcome, don't want to invest the labor of the creative self towards it. Mm. So a grant application often is the death of an art form, even though it's seeking to empower it because of this problem of sequencing.
No, this is we could be...
Yeah, I can
stuck.
Just tell him, like, I'm going to get the ding-dong
but,
here.
But the only thing I have to say this is that I think what you've said has been the thing that drove, that many of us came into this field for, and I should say that art is a spiritual activity, and art is not a vocation. It is an avocation. It's a calling. Yeah. All that sounds good, except now we live in a time, and I am trying to get this. I say it all the time, but my companion, Bjorn, is trying. I want to do a TED Talk. I want to challenge something I'm saying all the time. Arts are as important as highways and hospitals. Okay, well, hold on. Oprah, the spirit of Oprah is in the room. I know. But I think it's something else I'm trying to say is I don't know if I believe it anymore. Mm. I don't know, because you're talking... If there's a hospital, I want the best doctors there, and I want it when I want it. If the bridge is there, I want that bridge to be there. Now, what do I owe the grant writers? What do I owe the discourse? Should I know how to encourage people to come in and then, quote, instruct them, enrich them? There are the poor people, when they come in there, they want to be entertained. They want. That's what they want. They need to see Swan Lake. They need to see that leg go up. I know they do. They do. It's frustration for us that we've been trying for so many years, but okay, do you know better than they about what they need? So maybe if you want those dollars, and we need those dollars, you got to put out. You say arts are as important as highways and hospitals?
God knows you do.
Well, show me. Show me then that there's important. I don't know what it means. I'm not sure. Well, then wait. Next, somebody who knows what it means, get up here and let's talk, right?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
That's
sure.
The time we live in right now, and I'm sure you see it very up close. Fundraising.
Yeah, no. It's
the foundations, the corporations.
Sure, sure.
What do they want? What do I do? I can't rob them. How do I get them to fund me? I'm going to guarantee that this work is going to change things.
Yeah. No, but I do. One more question right here.
Yeah.
It's not a question, it's just a parenthesis, which I think is needed based on particularly what the lady was just saying when she was referring to the work that we have seen as being choreographed by Arnie Zane. Mm-hmm. That stems from something you said at the opening. All the works that have been seen have been choreographed jointly by you and Arnie.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
And
the collaborative
work. I think that you did not express that at the opening. So this small parenthesis so that everybody knows what they have
seen. Oh, I see. I'm sorry about that. Yeah, no. What you saw was our discussion when we were very young men. This is what was coming out of this Jewish-Italian 5'1" man and this African-American 6'1" man when they were trying to make their first works. This is what we were doing.
Yeah. Those are the choreographies. Well, okay, right here. He's right here. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So my question is probably a little off topic. Do you feel like there's a way the artist can prepare people to become celebrities and to lose it?
I'm sorry, say that again now.
I said, do you feel like there's a way that artists can prepare people to become celebrities?
Can prepare people
to become celebrities and to lose it.
And to lose it.
And to lose it.
Lose celebrity?
Yes.
So preparing to become celebrity and then lose the celebrity.
And artists can do that. You're asking, can artists do that?
I'm just curious if you've thought about that question.
I'm not quite sure I understand what it means.
Yeah.
I don't set out to prepare people to become celebrity.
No, I know, but I'm not trying to say like that's something that you should do. I'm just saying that because it's a question that I have because part of what we're talking about is the process of being an artist in a world where you're trying to attract dollars to yourself, right, to your company, to your institution, and part of that is getting known by the right people, and I feel like.
And part of that is I lost the last word.
Is being known by the right people. So you kind of live, my perception is you kind of live in a world where you have a level of celebrity, but you're also not to such a level of celebrity that everybody knows your name.
So not a household name, but famous.
You're asking, am I pleased with that state of being, or would I like to see it? Would I like it to be more famous or less famous? Is that what you're asking?
Bill is really seeking to understand the intent of the question.
I guess I just feel concerned about a culture that is so driven by celebrity. And I think about that because...
Yeah.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm concerned about the level at which pop culture depends on celebrity to say the things that is underneath the surface.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right.
Which has always been the case, don't you think? Always been the case.
Yeah. Yes. And then and there's that this way in which we've replaced success with material things with success by becoming a 15-minute celebrity. Contemporary culture.
Okay, now that's not my concern. I do think that there is a necessary level of visibility.
Yeah.
We have got to, there is a huge, as Jane Moss at Lincoln Center said to me once, there is a glut of product out there. And she pointed to an unsolicited barrel of CDs from people who are classical musicians who send them to her. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the question is, young artist, can you, and this is maybe a sin to ask that of the youth, how do you think what you're making or going to make, how does it land in the culture? And somebody says, I've had people say, I don't want it to land in the culture. I want it to land in my community. Mm-hmm. I want to be making work for people who think like I do. Now, so that's a very personal choice. I would like it to have the biggest possible audience, but I want to do it as much as possible on my terms.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah.
So, do I have to become Beyoncé or Jay-Z to do that? I cannot become Beyoncé or Jay-Z. And my nature is such that it would not have been good for my spiritual struggle to have done that. They do important things. They're literally inspiring people around the world. Mm. But there's something else, that peculiar stuff that those men were doing was coming out at a time, and it was saying loads about how I wanted to live in the world and the level of candor and so on. And that's also inspired people. Now, come to UCLA. See what we're doing with City Company. It's a big, sprawling, but very strong work that asks a lot of questions. It's entertaining, but it's not designed to be a work that's going to, go to the Oscar or something like that. It's not designed that way.
Right.
Yeah. It is a work that is tough in its own way. Mm. So when you come, no matter who you are, it won't insult you. And it might even entertain you. Mm. It might. Mm. That's all I can say. The other thing, and you know what? Don't worry about the 15 minutes of celebrity. Don't worry about it. Have you made your peace with the TV? I mean, this town is amazing. This is almost like my companion's 95-year-old French Jewish mother. She, very sophisticated lady. She's never been. Los Angeles, I don't think I would like it, would I? Why? Well, you know, it's like one long highway, isn't it? And, you know, it doesn't have very much culture, does it? Okay, now we know that's not true, and it is true. The billboards, the banality, you know? But you know what? There are individuals who did that. More power to them. And a lot of them are very talented. Do you know where to go in this town to get good mental food? And obviously you do.
Yeah.
But that is not the only thing. That's not the only thing that everybody needs. Mm-hmm. So let the fame machine work. You vote with your pocketbook. Am I going to go see 50 Shades of Grey? I probably will. Have I run out in the first 2 weeks to see it? No, I have not, you know. Vin Diesel. I like Vin Diesel. I'm going to go see Furious 7. I know it's horrible, you know. I have the discretionary cash. That's what my companion and I like to do. That's how we entertain ourselves. I don't confuse it with Tarkovsky, Renoir. I don't confuse it with Stanley Kubrick. Or I don't confuse it. I have enough education. I trust myself around pop culture. Yeah? Right. What I worry about, now here's the old, I worry about the very young. And that's, you know, that's another discussion. Your parents, you know.
It's another.
That's another discussion. Yeah.
But there is one thing for sure, that when each of us, in one way or another, receive a work of art, whether it be ephemeral or an object, there is something that that person has done. You can only have an aesthetic. We can have intellectual experiences like crazy. We can have emotional experiences like crazy. We can throw ourselves into deep dysfunction at any moment and spin all kinds of emotional experiences and then think about it together later. But an aesthetic experience tends to hit us in a different way. And it's the only kind, it's the kind of experience that only hits us in that way because of the endeavor of an artist. And in that endeavor, there is for sure something that artists are seeking to do with that proposition or possibility that it will go in, and that is to help us stay awake to the world.
Mm-hmm.
So here is one such man and one such artist who will be outside signing books. Thank you, Bill T. Jones. Thank you, Library.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.